And as mentioned, Hilchos Muktzah is very, very important. It comes up all the time. Every Shabbos we're confronted with all kinds of questions, and I thought it was a good opportunity for us to go through some of the issues. Obviously, Hilchos Muktzah we can learn for 6 months, but we're just going to highlight, like we did for Amir al-Nahri, really just the highlights, the things that come up all the time, and try to familiarize ourselves with the general categories and principles that we need to be aware of. So we begin with the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, Daf Lamed Amid Aleph. And the Gemara there doesn't get into the detail exactly of how everything started, but if you look in a pasuk in Tehillim, you'll see that there's a very fascinating request that David HaMelech asks of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So David HaMelech says, Hodieni Hashem Kitzi. Anybody knows what that means? Hodieni Hashem means God should tell me. Kitzi means my end. So what does that mean? HaKadosh Baruch Hu should tell me my end? Umidas Yamai Mahi. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God should please tell me how long my days are. Eda me chadel ani. So what exactly does that mean? Chazal explained to us that there were three components to the request that David HaMelech made of the Ribono Shel Olam. Number one, Hodieni Hashem Kitzi. David HaMelech wanted to know, when am I going to die? How long am I going to live? Wouldn't it be amazing if all of us knew exactly how many years we were given on this earth? So we're all young, and I consider myself a part of the young group. So we're all young. And we believe that we're going to live forever. And therefore we have time to just spend our time however we'd like to and do whatever we want and enjoy life because we'll get serious later on and we'll all work itself out and we'll all be fine. And nobody believes that my life is actually going to be shorter than expected. And unfortunately you see, like in the news this morning, that you have three young people who were in the prime of their lives who unfortunately were in a terror attack in Israel. And Hodieni Hashem Kitzi. Had they been told that their lives were going to end at 50 years old, they probably would have done certain things differently. So David HaMelech wants to know, can you tell me, give me some insight, how long am I going to live? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Gzeirahi Melefanai, this is the way it goes, that we don't tell people how long they're going to live. You have to make the most of life, and we don't give you that secret, we don't give you that insight. The second question that he wanted to know was, Midas Yamai Mahi, I want to know, how many days I'm going to live? How many years? Not only what my end is going to be, how I'm going to pass from this world, but exactly when. And finally, Eda mechadal ani, Chazal say that means, what day of the week? HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I'm not going to tell you if you're going to get sick in the end. I'm not going to tell you how many years you're going to live. So David HaMelech pleads with him and he says, at least tell me what day of the week I should expect to pass on from this earth. Why does that matter? You'll see in a second. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, that final request I'll give you. I'm not going to tell you what year, I'm not going to tell you how it's going to happen, but I will tell you which day of the week your final day is going to be on this earth. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him that you're going to pass away on a Shabbos. Why is he going to pass away on a Shabbos? So the Gemara says, because it's time for Shlomo HaMelech to take over. Ve'ein malchus achas nogas bechaverta afilu kamalei nima. When the time comes for Shlomo HaMelech to be in charge, to be the Melech Yisrael, you're out. You're out. And there's going to be no overlap at all. So that is what David HaMelech said. Originally, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him he's going to pass away on Shabbos, David HaMelech says, I'm concerned. If I'm going to die on Shabbos, I'm not going to be buried on Shabbos because you're not allowed to bury someone on Shabbos. So he says, I'd rather pass away on Sunday. He's negotiating. Let me have one more day. Let me pass away on Sunday. Which is, the whole conversation is shocking. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, I would love to keep you alive a little bit longer, but it's time for Shlomo HaMelech to take over. And once it's time for him to take over, we can't have you around anymore. That's what he's told. So that's the end of the story, that Shlomo HaMelech was going to take over on a Sunday morning, on a Matzah Shabbos, and therefore David HaMelech had to pass away on a Shabbos. That's what the Gemara tells us. David HaMelech makes a decision. He's going to outsmart the Malach HaMelech. He's going to figure out how to make sure that he doesn't die on Shabbos. So how do you do that? David HaMelech spends his whole Shabbos engaged in such intense Talmud Torah. And he says, while I'm learning Torah, how is it possible that the angel of death, that the Malach HaMavis, is going to come and kill me? And that's what he did every Shabbos. Because God told him the secret. You're going to die on a Shabbos. And he says, I'm going to outsmart him. I'm going to figure out how to make sure that I don't die on Shabbos. So that was the back and forth. That was the interesting discussion that the Gemara has. So what ends up happening? The Gemara tells us that ultimately, David HaMelech goes outside, and he hears that there's some rustling in a tree somewhere, and he gets distracted from whatever it is he was doing, and he was no longer learning Torah. And at that moment, the Malach HaMavis comes and killed him. Now, the whole thing was a setup. The Malach HaMavis went out to the tree and started shaking it and tried to distract him. And that is when he finally had the opportunity to do so. Anyway, that's the story the Gemara shares. That's what we're told. And that's really what happened with David HaMelech. So, how does this have any relevance to our case here? Just by the way, there's a big discussion because we're also told that the Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, Daf Lamed, that David HaMelech dies on Shabbos, but at the same time, the Yerushalmi says that David HaMelech dies on Shavuos. Right? We know that on Shavuos we commemorate the life and legacy of David HaMelech, and if that's the case, is it actually possible that Shavuos can fall out on a Shabbos? So you have to go through all the mathematical calculations. I happen not to be a calendar person at all, but if I would ask my 11-year-old son, he knows this inside out about which dates something could be in Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot and Tisha B'Av and Pesach. I don't know, like if you're one of those people and you have a knack for it, so you get it. If you don't, you'll never get it. So I'm one of those people who will just never get it. So if you do the calculation, Shavuos cannot really be on a Shabbos. So that's why there's a little bit of a discrepancy here exactly when he died. Anyway, that's all a sidebar. Why is it relevant to the story of Buksa? So the Gemara there is talking about Shlomo HaMelech had a major problem. And the Gemara tells us that after his father passed away on a Shabbos afternoon, Shlomo HaMelech really was not sure exactly what to do. So the Gemara says that he walks into the Beis Medrash, and Shlomo, even though he was the Chacham Likal Adam, wasn't exactly sure what to do. So he walks into the Beis Medrash, and he says, I have a Shaila. My father passed away, and I want to know, is my father's body, he says, how am I allowed to move it? How am I allowed to move my father's body? He passed away outside, as we mentioned. He was distracted by the trees. He passed away outside. If we're going to leave his body outside, it's going to decompose from the sun. It was a burning hot day in the middle of the summer. So what are we going to do? So Shlomo HaMelech comes in and he says, how can I make my father's body be moved from the outdoors to be somewhere inside where it won't decompose? Now, why did Shlomo HaMelech not say, is my father's body allowed to be moved at all? That wasn't his question. There was an assumption that his father's body was not allowed to be moved. What you see is that there was already, in the times of David HaMelech and the times of Shlomo, there was already an assumption that there's this idea of muktzah. Right? Because from the way Shlomo HaMelech formulates the question, it's clear that muktzah was something that was already in motion at that time. If not, he would have asked, can I move my father's body? Not the question he asked. The question he asked was, I know I'm not allowed to, but let's figure out a way to get around the system and move the body. That's what the Gemara says. The problem is we have another Gemara, where the Gemara tells us in Maseches Shabbos, Kuf Chav Gimel, there was one of the great leaders of the Jewish people whose name was Nehemiah. Anybody know when he lived? When did David HaMelech live in the context of Jewish history? What? Before Churban Bayis Rishon, before the building of the Bayis Rishon, right? David HaMelech, the Psukim tell us, you're correct, David HaMelech says that he very much wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash. And this was his dream, his aspiration in his entire experience of life. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to him, it's both in Sefer Melachim, as well as in Sefer Divrei HaYamim, where the Pasuk says, David HaMelech, I appreciate all of your efforts, but unfortunately you cannot be the one. Dam l'rov shafachta. Unfortunately you have been involved in bloodshed. You've gone out to war. And somebody whose hands are spilled, are involved in blood being spilled, cannot be the one who's designated to go ahead and build the Beis HaMikdash, even though it's not David HaMelech's fault. Whatever you want to say, the bottom line is David HaMelech's request was denied, and he was unable to build the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you're going to have his son Shlomo, and he's going to have full license to go ahead and build the Beis HaMikdash, and that is what ended up ultimately happening. So David HaMelech and Shlomo were before the Bayis Rishon, before the first Beis HaMikdash was built. They were the ones who were behind the building of the first Beis HaMikdash. Then, a couple of hundred years go by, Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, the Jewish people go into exile. 70 years later, the Navi told them they were going to have the right to return. They all come back to Eretz Yisrael, and who is the leader of the charge at the time? Who is the leader of the charge at the time? Anybody know? Who led the Jewish people then? I'll give you a minute to think. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam shehakol mihiyeh b'dvaro. Nobody knows. Maybe next semester we should learn a little bit of Jewish history. How's that? Maybe it's a good idea. So, Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah were the leaders of the Jewish community at the time. Ezra and Nehemiah actually had a very difficult time. They were trying to encourage the Jewish people to go back to Eretz Israel. 70 years had already passed since they were exiled. They already had the right to go back, and nobody listened to them. Nobody was interested, which is the same thing that happens in our generation. We're given the right to return, and we all have the ability to move to Eretz Yisrael, and a very small percentage of the Jewish community actually heed the call and go back, and myself included. I'm just as guilty as everybody else here. But that's really where the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people is supposed to be. And so much so that the Navi tells us that Ezra and Nehemiah, when they got to the Yarden, when they got to the Jordan River, and they were about to go into Eretz Yisrael, they turned around to count, do we even have enough Kohanim and Levim to have a functioning Beis HaMikdash? Do we even have enough people here who can do everything that needs to be done in the Jewish community? And they turned around and said, we really don't have enough. And as a result of that, they had to go back and galvanize a couple of more people to come back to have a functioning society in Yerushalayim, to be able to build up Eretz Yisrael again. Be it as it may, the Gemara says that in the days of Nehemiah, there was a gzeira of Muktzah that was enacted. And the question is, what do you mean? But Nehemiah lived hundreds of years after David HaMelech. And already in the days of David HaMelech, this was already in motion. So who is the one who came up with this idea of Muktzah? Was it Nehemiah? Or was it somebody that came way beforehand, which was in the days of David HaMelech? And the answer that the Acharonim give is that the general concept, the general idea of Muktzah was already around from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. After all, in the Pasuk in Sefer Shmos, it says, Vayom HaShvi Tishbos. On the seventh day, you should rest. And what does it mean? You should sleep? It's not what it means. Rather, it means, Chazal say, it's a reference to the fact that we should not handle Muktzah, even though it's not really a malacha on Shabbos, even though it's not one of the explicitly prohibited activities on Shabbos. But Muktzah was already something that Moshe Rabbeinu alluded to in the Chumash when he said, Bayom HaShvi Tishbos. And as a result of that, David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech understood that when they were confronted with their issue on Shabbos, Muktzah was going to be an issue. And that's why Shlomo HaMelech walks in and he says, what do I do? There's a problem with Muktzah. What do I do? My father passed away. I don't want to leave him outside. I don't want the body to decompose. I'm not sure exactly how to handle this. That is what happened then. Nehemiah came along hundreds of years later and he said, nobody's being careful at all with Muktzah, and therefore we need to re-emphasize Muktzah again. We need to put new protocols in place to make sure that people are going to follow this prohibition of Muktzah on Shabbos. And that's really where all of it comes from. But be it as it may, it is clear that this is only a gzeira midrabbanan. Again, it might be alluded to in a pasuk in Chumash by Yom HaShvi'i Tishbos, but it's not something that is learned directly from a pasuk in Chumash. It is something that is only a din midrabbanan. Now, as we mentioned in the last set of shiurim, every gzeira midrabbanan, every rabbinic inaction is something that needs to have a justification for its institution. The rabbis, the chachamim, chazal, don't just have a right to say whatever they want. There always has to be a delicate balance between two opposing values. On the one hand, the Torah says, we have a prohibition of bal tosif. You're not just allowed to add something to the Torah just because you feel like it. On the other hand, we have an opposing factor that we need to think about, and that is, the Torah says, asu siyag la Torah, ushmartam es mishmarti. That the rabbis in every generation, the leaders of every generation, need to size up the community and understand, what is it that our community is failing at? What is it that their pitfall is? What is it that their difficulty, their struggle is about? And how are we going to address it? We need to make sure that the Torah is going to be relevant for every generation. And sometimes if we have a major issue in one direction, in a certain generation, we have to go to the extreme in that particular generation. So we have those two opposing views all the time. And the question here is, what was the impetus? What was the reason why the Chachamim said that Muktzah is something that is relevant for us on Shabbos? What was their justification? So the answer is, it's a four-way dispute among the Rishonim. The Ravid writes, and the Ravid often is the one who disagrees with the Rambam, and this is no exception to that. The Ravid says, and this is what Rashi and Tosfos write in Maseches Beitza as well, that the reason why Muktzah was instituted is because there's a malacha on Shabbos of Hotza'ah. Hotza'ah means you're not allowed to carry something outside in the street on Shabbos. Now, if you're going to be walking around your house and handling all kinds of items on Shabbos, and you're going to be walking all over the house and the building and your backyard and all over the place, then what's the likelihood that when you go outside, out of the confines of your house, that you're actually going to remember to take that item and put it down before you leave the house? And that is why there was a gzeira, that is why there was an institution of Muktzah, because they were concerned that you're going to violate, ultimately, the biblical prohibition of Hotza. That's where that came from. Which is why, if you live in a community that doesn't have an Eruv, you have to be very mindful of the fact that sometimes you have things in your pockets, sometimes you put something, I don't know I put things in my pockets. I don't know how many of you have pockets on your clothing, but sometimes you put things in a pocket and you don't really remember before going outside that I have to make sure that everything is taken out. So that's what the Ravid says. The whole prohibition of muksa came from this idea that we have to be concerned that one is going to ultimately violate the malacha of hotza. The Rambam says that there are other reasons why muksa was instituted. Perhaps some say the reason why is because if you're going to carry objects that are generally used to do a malacha, for example, if I'm going to carry a pen or a pencil, usually that's going to lead me to write something down or to doodle. If I'm just not going to have any contact with that on Shabbos, it will keep me away from doing a malacha that's normally done with that item. So that is the second reason quoted in the Rishonim for the prohibition of muktzah on Shabbos. The third reason that the Rambam gives is because we have a commandment in the Navi where he says that we have to have Shabbos as being very distinct and very different. Shelo yehei hiluchach b'chol ki hiluchach b'Shabbos. The way that we act, the way that we speak, the way that we behave on Shabbos has to be different than the way that we behave during the week. And that is why there are many different things that we're not supposed to do on Shabbos, even though it may not be outlined in Shulchan Aruch, but it's an opportunity for us to highlight the fact that we want our experience of Shabbos to be categorically different than the experience during the week. And therefore the Rambam says, if we're going to handle all the regular items that we do during the week, then how is there going to be any distinction between the way that we handle things on Shabbos and the way that we handle things during the week? So therefore the Rambam says, that is why the institution of muktzah came about, to make it categorically different from the way that we experience every other day of the week. My father has a very interesting comment in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, where he said, when we have early Shabbos, let's say now, so we have early Shabbos, and take the opposite example. Let's say we have Shabbos starting at 7:30, right? So not everybody wants to start Shabbos at 7:30. It's funny, because in the winter time we all say, oh, Shabbos is at 4:30, it's so much pressure and we're rushing and we're this. We wish that Shabbos would be at like 7 o'clock. Then in the summertime when Shabbos is at 7 or 8 o'clock, we say, oh, like Shabbos is so late, I'm so exhausted, let me make Shabbos earlier. You know, it's never right. Like everybody always says, Yontif this year is late. Yontif this year is early. I once asked my wife, is Yontif ever on time? Like, is it ever the right time? It's always like, oh, it's so late in the season, it's so early in the season. Like, okay, Yontif is when Yontif is. It's supposed to be when it is. So that's the same over here. We have people who in the summertime, when Shabbos is called for, let's say, 7:30, so they're going to bring Shabbos in earlier. Why do they want to bring Shabbos in earlier? Not because they feel that they want the more extra opportunity of Kedusha Shabbos, but rather they take it in earlier because they say, I have a bunch of children, and my kids eat dinner every night at 6 o'clock. If I'm going to bring Shabbos in at 7:30, it's going to throw off the whole schedule. And therefore, to have that time, which is the same time every single night when we eat dinner in our house, let's make sure that we have Shabbos early also. Rav Soloveitchik said that would not be allowed. Again, to take in Shabbos early is fine. But to take in Shabbos early strictly because I like to eat dinner at 6 o'clock and I don't want to break from that habit, that is exactly what Chazal say from the Nabi. Shelo yehei hiluchach b'Shabbos ki hiluchach l'chol. The way that you observe Shabbos needs to be different than the way that you observe every other day of the week. Now, maybe that's an extreme example that Rav Soloveitchik gave, but his point is very obvious. The point is that we should try to go out of our way to make the experience of Shabbos different than the experience that we would otherwise have any other day of the week. So that is reason number three. And reason number four is the Rambam gives us an idea. And he says, let's say you have somebody who, Rahmana Litzlanu, God forbid, is in a nursing home. And there's not so much activity they're going to do anyway. They're not going to go outside. They don't really do so much malacha. They don't go to work anyway. So it's not like on Shabbos they're going to stay home from work and exhibit the fact that they're honoring Shabbos. There is no real way for that individual to show that they respect Shabbos or that Shabbos is anything to them. And therefore the Rambam says that perhaps the only way to do that for such an individual is by instituting a new idea, which is muksa. How is that person in the nursing home who otherwise would touch a pen, who otherwise would touch certain items, but now today has to show that it's Shabbos for them. So they don't go to work anyway. They don't leave the confines of the nursing home anyway. They have nothing that they can do. The only way to do that for them, to highlight the uniqueness of Shabbos, is to say, today you're not going to pick up your cell phone, and today you're not going to pick up a pen, and today everything that you touch is going to be different than the things that you're allowed to touch during the week. So again, four opinions in the Rishonim, where this whole idea, where this concept of muktzah stems from. Number one, we have the Ravid, Rashi, and Tosas, who say that the whole idea comes from a prohibition of Hotzah. We're not allowed to carry outside on Shabbos, and because we have a concern that if people are going to be carrying all the time, it may lead them to then carry outside without an Eruv. So that would be a problem, and that is why Muktzah was something that was considered to be a relevant concern, and that is where it came from. The second idea is that maybe we want Hiluchach b'Shabbos, Hiluchach b'Chol. We want a totally different kind of observance of Shabbos than we have during the week, and therefore we make sure to have everything that we do on Shabbos is going to be different than we do during the week, not only the way we speak, not only the way we walk, but also the way that we handle items. Number three, the Rishonim say the reason why is because we're concerned if you're going to handle something which a malacha is normally done with, it will lead you to do a malacha. If I'm going to have my phone on Shabbos, I'm probably going to then go the next step and do a malacha with that phone on Shabbos. If I'm going to handle a pen on Shabbos, I'm probably going to end up writing with that pen. And therefore, the Rishonim say, this is where the idea of muktzah comes from. And finally, the reason why is because if you have an individual who has no way to highlight the uniqueness of Shabbos for them, this is the way to do so, by saying that certain items are off limits for them, and therefore we have the gzeirah of muktzah. Now, before we get into all the different minutiae of exactly what muktzah applies to, when it's allowed, when perhaps it's not allowed, we first have to identify what exactly are the categories of muktzah that we are describing. So the first one we're going to talk about, I guess I should be a real teacher and write on the board a little bit. Would that help everybody? Okay. So the first category of muktzah that we need to talk about is what's referred to in the Shulchan Aruch as muktzah. I haven't done this in probably 20 years. And that's why I don't even know how to use it. It doesn't work. Okay. Well then, it's a good idea. Is there another one?
There might be a different one, a red one there. I don't know if it has this column. So it's open.
Let's see. Okay, so category number one is, do any of your other teachers write on the board? Can anyone read that? Good? Fair? Okay, the first category is what we refer to as muktzah machmas chisaron kis. Chisaron kis means, if you translate the words, chisaron kis means a loss of money. So what does it mean that something is muktzah machmas chisaron kis? It means this is set aside. Muktzah means akse midaite. It's out of my league for this Shabbos. I have no intent on using this over Shabbos. Why do I have no intent in using this item over Shabbos? Because it is something that involves a chisaron kis. Take, for example, anybody here play an instrument? What do you play? Piano. What do you play?
Violin.
Violin's a great example. Piano, maybe not so much, because piano you don't really move. But a violin you can move on Shabbos, right? You can move it around. So would you be allowed to take your violin on Shabbos? The answer is no. Why not? Not just that you're not allowed to play a violin on Shabbos. That's a separate prohibition. Why are we not allowed to play music on Shabbos?
You may come to fix it.
So the Gemara says you may come to fix it. So that is the reason why you're not allowed to play it. But let's say I want to move it from place A to place B. Why would I not be allowed to do that? Because it involves chisaron kis. How expensive is your violin? Violins are pretty expensive, right? I assume a few hundred dollars?
Yeah.
More? Stradivarius? More?
No, okay. It's very rare. Stradivarius, regular
one. Oh, so a regular one is $500. So a violin is something that involves chisaron kis. If I'm going to have people handling the violin and moving it all over the place, it's going to break. And therefore, because I don't like it to be moved around, I don't like it to be handled so much, that is called in the category of chisaron kis, and therefore we would say that is category number one of muktzah. We'll give a couple more examples in a minute. Let's see, category number two is, anybody know? What's category number two that the Shulchan Aruch talks about? It's what's referred to as a kli shemalacha le'iser.
Is this the same order that the Shulchan Aruch presents them?
I think so. This is the order that we're going to talk about. So, kli shemalachta le'iser. What is a kli shemalachta le'iser? When you have an item that is always used to do a malacha. For example, what's a great example? A pen. Right? A pen is something that I always use to do a malacha, to write. And therefore, that would be something that on Shabbos is off limits because the only purpose it serves is to do an iser, to do something wrong. On Shabbos, obviously. So that would be, let's say, a pen. This would be a violin. Okay, which brings us to category number three. What is category number three? And again, we're going to get into the details in a few minutes. I just want to set up the categories. Category number three is something that is called Muktzah Machmas Gufo. What does Muktzah Machmas Gufo mean? Means it's something that has absolutely no purpose at all. Now, what is something that has no purpose at all? Everything has a purpose. What's something that has no purpose for me on Shabbos at all? Shulchan Aruch says, for example, Eitzim ve'avanim mi'afar, which means dirt. What purpose do you have for dirt on Shabbos? You're not going to plant with it. What are you going to do with dirt on Shabbos? Or, for example, if you have avanim, if you have stones, what purpose do you have for stones? Now, my father always points out a apocryphal example, but he says, imagine you live in Mea Shearim and you like to throw stones at the cars that are driving on Shabbos, and therefore the stones have a very important purpose. And they're not just being stones, this is a joke, but if you believe in that school of thought that that's an important thing for you to do, then for you, the stones are not going to be muktzah machmas gufo because they have a very important purpose. Now, I would tend to disagree with the whole premise, but that's just an example. So this would be, let's say, stones, or as we said, dirt. That would be something that is category number three, muktzah machmas gufo. Okay. Then we get to category number four. What is category number four? It's what we refer to as a basis ledavar ha'aser. Basis ledavar ha'aser, we'll see in a minute what that is. A basis ledavar ha'aser. Anybody knows what that means? Basis ledavar ha'aser is something which on its own has nothing wrong with it. It's not inherently problematic. But because it's holding something which is muktzah, it now becomes muktzah as well. So say, for example, I light Shabbos candles, right? So I'm not allowed to handle the Shabbos candles because that would be muktzah. What about if I have them on a tray? And the tray is holding the candlesticks. It's holding the candelabra. Would I be allowed to move the tray? The answer is no. That's a basis ledavar ha'aser. That is holding something that is muktzah on it. Okay? So I would say the... let's just say tray... underneath. Candelabra. Okay? Is that clear? What did I do wrong? Okay. And number five, is there anything that's not clear so far? So far so good? Okay. Category number five, which is less well known, is Mukta Machmas Mechusar Tzeda or Mechusar Maisa. I know that's sounds very long. Okay, so let me just write. Machmas Seida. Or. Wow, this is a real learning experience for me. Okay, Muktzah Machmas Seida or Mechusar Maisa. What that means is an apple Muktzah on Shabbos? No, an apple is not Muktzah on Shabbos. Why? Because it has a very important purpose. I can eat it. Is an apple on a tree muktzah on Shabbos? Yes. Why? Because I have no access to it. I'm not allowed to pluck something off a tree on Shabbos, and therefore, right now, as far as I'm concerned, when Shabbos came in, that was off limits to me. Now, what happens if Shabbos morning, that apple falls off the tree? So now it's no longer off limits to me. I don't need to do any malacha to get it. The malacha happened by itself. So would I be allowed on Shabbos afternoon to go outside, take that apple, and eat it? The answer is no. Why? Because at the time when Shabbos came in, I had no way of getting that apple without a malacha being done. And therefore, once Shabbos began, it's already considered to be off limits, and that will retain its status for the entire duration of Shabbos, even if something changes over the course of Shabbos, meaning that it falls off the tree by itself. So that would be a fifth category of muktzah. And the sixth is what's referred to as muktzah machmas mitzvah. Okay, let me see what that is. Anybody knows what that is? Muktzah machmas mitzvah? Muktzah machmas mitzvah means, how could a mitzvah make something muktzah? That's like a contradiction in terms. That doesn't make sense. Muktzah machmas mitzvah means, say, for example, it's Sukkos. and I have a lulav and esrog, and I designated the lulav and esrog to be used for the entire duration of Yom Tov. Now it's on the fifth day, and I realize, oh, it would really be nice if I was able to have a, you know, some lemons or some citrus squeezed into my salad dressing or the salad that I'm eating, whatever it may be. The problem is that when Yom Tov came in, when Sukkot came in, I had designated this to be used for the mitzvah. And I had no intent at all to use it for anything else. If I would use it for something else, it would be ruined for the mitzvah. If I'm not going to go and slice it up and put it into a salad, that would not allow me to then do the mitzvah that I want to do. So as a result of that, Chazal said that there's a category of muktzah referred to as muktzah machmas mitzvah. Because this is set aside to do a mitzvah with it, therefore, it is now considered to be off limits because I want to use it specifically for the mitzvah, and anything that I'm going to use it for otherwise is going to discredit it or disqualify it from being used toward that mitzvah. Okay, so these are the six general categories of muktzah, and these are what we're going to discuss over the next two or three shiur. Yes?
Would the last one apply to non-Shabbos and you can't do something that's set aside for a mitzvah to do something else with it?
So it depends what? Give me an example. Yeah, so one very common example is, the Gemara says that your decorations from the sukkah are muktzah, iskatzai leben ashmashos, it's something that's set aside for the entire duration of sukkahs. You ever heard of that before? If you have decorations on the sukkah, so if they fall down, what do people do? I've gotten this question so many times, every year, the same question. The Gemara says that sukkah decorations that fall down are considered to be muktzah. So people think that means what? Nobody ever had this question?
You can't touch it.
People think it means you're not allowed to touch it. Because that's what we associate muktzah with. We say, oh, muktzah means you're not allowed to touch something. Muktzah means you're not allowed to move something. That's not what it means in this context. When we talk about a sukkah decoration, it's your muktzah, which means it's set aside for the mitzvah, and therefore it cannot be used for another purpose. So when sukkah is over, and I no longer need this chain to decorate my sukkah, yes, you can hang it up in your bedroom and you can do whatever you want with it and you can have a great time. But on sukkahs itself, you wouldn't be allowed to do that. Muktzah on sukkahs doesn't mean that you're not allowed to touch it. It means you're not allowed to use it for your own personal purposes. So that's just a defining term that we have to make clear, because sometimes it means one thing, sometimes it means something else. And part of what makes it complicated today, we're a very blessed generation that we have the ability to do Google searches and we can go on Bar Ilan and Otzer HaChachma and find all kinds of things. You put in a hit word and you find something, but not always does everything mean the same thing, even though it uses the same Hebrew word. So say, for example, you would type in muktzah, you would come up with this, but it really has no connection at all. It's a totally separate category of muktzah, and you very correctly pointed it out, that it wouldn't be necessarily the same, and the laws that govern both of them would not be the same at all. Does that help clarify a little bit?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I answered your question or if I just went on a big detour.
I'd ask if something was off limits just during the week as well, just a regular day.
Yes, so say for example, a sukkah decoration would be, yes. Or esrog would also be the same thing, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Also, my question is not mitzvah. So let's say men who have a talis for the week and a talis for Shabbos, would they be able if they don't find, they don't have available the one for Shabbos, use the same one they use during the week for Shabbos?
Would you be allowed to?
Yes.
Yeah, set aside as a talis. That's not a...
You're not using it for your own purposes. You only use it during the week.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. There was a shaila that we dealt with this year, Sukkot. What was the problem? The problem was we were told before Yom Tov that the flights that were taking off from America were going to land in Israel right before the Shkia. Which is fine. Not a big deal. So you land right before the Shkia. It's okay. You daven mincha before you land. So what was the problem? The problem was the customs in Israel was not allowing people to bring dalet minim, to bring the lulav and esrog through onto the Israeli side. So anybody who would be found to have a lulav or esrog with them, it would be confiscated. And the rule, nothing to do with sukkahs, but the rule officially is that any produce that is confiscated in the airport by customs is burnt. Not just that they dispose of it, they burn it. So the question here was, people had a shaila they wanted to know. They're going to be taking off from the United States on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. Let's say people stayed home the first days, they're going to Israel for the rest of Yom Tov. So they're going to be taking off on Chol HaMoed Sukkot on a Monday night. So they can't shake lulav Monday night. when they land in Israel, they can't shake lulav because it's already after the Shkia. Right? They're landing at 4 o'clock. The Shkia is, let's say, at 4:10. They're not going to have enough time to get to the other side of customs and find the lulav and esrog. So they're not able to shake the lulav and esrog there. So the question here is, were they allowed to bring the lulav and esrog on the plane with them, knowing full well that when they get to Israel, the security is going to take it away and burn it? Is that permissible or not? So what do you say? It's an interesting shaila. In the end, I'm not sure why, but for some reason, many people that I know went to Israel on Sukkot and had no problem at all. Customs didn't take away anything. So I'm not sure exactly where the misinformation came from or what the problem was, but theoretically, it's a very interesting question. Am I allowed to bring something on the plane that is huksel mitzvaso, that is set aside for a mitzvah, and is not supposed to be done used for any other purpose? Am I allowed to do that, knowing full well that it's going to be burnt on Sukkot while it can still be used for the mitzvah going forward? Is that something that's permissible or not? That was the question. Yeah?
If you would make the set puzzle, I mean, each meal puzzle wouldn't be able to be. If you do the mitzvah, then you ruin it. You ruin the
talent. Are you allowed to ruin it? That's the question. Are you allowed to ruin it? So the Gemara says, if I set aside 7 esrogim for each day of Sukkot and I say, I'm such a fancy person, I only use an esrog once. I'm a disposable generation. So I use my esrog once and then I pay money to have an esrog. So then it was never huksel mitzvasa for the whole Sukkot. I never set it aside for the whole Yom Tov. I set it aside just for one day. Then the next day I set aside for something else. The next day another one, another one, another one. So then once you're done with it for that day of the mitzvah, you're finished. But over here, in a general sense, people buy a lulav and esrog and use it for the entire duration of Yom Tov. And the question is, would I be allowed to do this or not? Okay, that's just a diversion, a different thing to consider, but very much related to the question that you asked before. So, before we get into what's not allowed, let's first get into permissible ways for a person to handle muktzah on Shabbos. Okay, and I think this is a common misconception. Number one, the only prohibition that applies to muktzah is when you carry or you move muktzah. But people mistakenly think that touching muktzah is always a problem as well. So very often you'll see a young child is touching something and the parents say, oh, don't touch, it's muktzah. That's a mistake. There's no prohibition with touching muktzah. The only prohibition is with moving muktzah. Now, most of the times you touch something, it's probably going to move, right? But let's say, for example, you're taking a walk or you have a rock in your shoe on Shabbos and you got to stop. But you're going to lose your balance if you take your high heels off, and you don't want to tip over. So what do? So you go to a car and you put your weight on the car and you take off your shoe, correct? Nobody's ever done that. Amazing! Wow, you've never gotten
sweet.
What?
We have like a TV that looks like a picture frame, and like one of my friends was like, "Is that a picture frame?" And they started touching it, and they're like, "Shoo, it's muktzah." I'm like, "No, you're not moving it."
Well, now you have to be extra concerned because most of them are touchscreens.
No, they're not.
Okay, so that's an added consideration. But in general, touching muktzah is not a problem. Handling and moving muktzah is a problem. So therefore, if you have that stone stuck in your shoe on Shabbos and you need to take your shoes off and you don't want to lose your balance, yes, you can put your weight onto a car and you can hold onto it while you do whatever you need to do and then you keep moving. That would not be a problem at all. That's number one, a very important halakha that we need to be aware of. Number two, the only time that Chazal said that muktzah is a problem is if you carry it or you move it in the normal way that somebody would generally carry something. Get to your question in a minute. But let's say, for example, I do what's referred to as tiltul kala acharyat. I carry something in a very unusual manner. How do I normally carry a marker? I carry it like this in my hands. What if I would carry something like this in between my arms? That's not a normal way to carry anything, right? You don't put your arms together and carry a pen. And therefore, we assume that if you do it that way, that is not really part of the prohibition of muktzah, and that is not really what they had in mind. The same thing would be tiltul begufo. If I use my body to carry something, right? Like I put something on my head. It's not the normal way to carry either, as you can see. It doesn't work. So in a situation like that, that would also not be considered a act of tiltul muktzah because you're doing it in an unusual manner. So Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach tries to figure out why this is the case. Why would there not be a prohibition of muktzah if you're carrying something kila achar yad in an unusual manner? So Rav Asher Weiss once told me perhaps the reason why is the same way by every malacha of Shabbos, something that we spoke about I think last week or 2 weeks ago, that when you have a malacha on Shabbos, the only way to violate it is if you do it in the normal way, what's referred to as malachas machsheves. I have to deliberately have in mind to do what I'm doing, Not that something happens by itself. It's that I have in mind to make this happen. If I don't have that in mind, that's not called a malacha. And the same would be over here. The only time muktzah is a problem is when it's done in a normal fashion. That's part of malachas machsheves. But if I do something in a very unusual fashion, that would not be a problem. And therefore, that is a very important principle to be aware of as well. And that's why sometimes we have a situation of muktzah that's going to be somewhere, and perhaps the answer to take care of it is to kick it with your foot. Even though you are the reason why it's moving, but that's kila acharya. That's a very unusual way for a person to move an item from place A to place B. And number three, the Shulchan Aruch says, if you're indirectly moving muktzah for the sake of a permissible object, that is also considered to be okay. And the term in Hebrew that he uses is tiltul mid hatzad, letzoreth davar hamutter. Tiltul mid hatzad means an indirect movement of the muktzah item, but only because I'm doing it letzoreth davar hamutter. For example, what's the example? The example the Shulchan Aruch gives is something that never comes up today, because we're just not familiar with that. But if you just extrapolate from there to normal cases that we're used to, you can obviously think of very relevant cases that would be familiar to us. So for example, the Shulchan Aruch says, let's say I put a carrot in the ground. I had a carrot that was edible. Now I put it into the ground. Why am I putting it in the ground? Why would you do such a thing? You want to prevent it from rotting. They didn't have a refrigerator. So what are you going to do with it? So you put it back into the ground. Now, on Shabbos, I want to eat that carrot. So what do? I pull it out of the ground. What's going to happen when I pull it out of the ground? In advanced science, what happens when you have something that is stuffed into the ground and then you pull it out? What happens? All the dirt is going to move. It's all going to be displaced. It's going to start moving around. So am I allowed to move dirt on Shabbos? No, that's muktzah. Which category of muktzah is that? Muktzah machmas gufo, category 3. Dirt has no purpose. This also has no purpose. So I'm not allowed to move it on Shabbos. But the only reason why I'm moving it is because I need to get the carrot out. The only way to get the carrot out is by moving the dirt. So when I yank the carrot out, I'm inadvertently going to also move the dirt that surrounds it. That would be okay, says the Shulchan Aruch, because that's called tiltul min hatzad, letzorech davar hamutar. I'm indirectly moving something, but I'm really doing it only for the purpose of the permissible item that I'm trying to get to. And therefore, that would be allowed. You had a question. Yeah.
Would you be allowed to move something that is muktzah to get something else that isn't?
Give me an example.
If there's a pen on the book that you want to read, can you swat away the pen?
Okay, so we're going to get to all these examples. Okay, so I think the best way to handle that would be tiltul min hatzad, if you do it in an unusual fashion. So let's say I have a pen on a book, and I just go like this with the cover of the book and push it off. That would be tiltul min hatzad. That's not the normal way that I would move an item from place A to place B. So that would be okay. But we're going to get more into the details of all this. I just felt it was important to first introduce the categories and to know them clearly, and then we'll move on from there. So let's go to category number one. Any other questions before we go to category one? We're good so far? Okay. So we have category one is muktzah machmas chisaron kis. What exactly is muktzah machmas chisaron kis? So the rule is when you have muktzah machmas chisaron kis, you're not allowed to move it even if I need something put in its place. So say for example, let's go back to the violin example. When I have a violin and I mistakenly leave it on the dining room table, and now it comes Shabbos and I want to have a meal there. So that's called Tzorech Mekoma. I need the space. I need someone to sit there. The problem is there's a violin in the way. Would I be allowed to move the violin in order that somebody should be able to sit there? I'm not moving the violin for its own sake. I'm moving it because I need the space. Would that be something that is permissible or not? Shulchan Aruch says no. You would not be allowed to move a muktzah machmas chisaron kis, even if it would be l'tzorach makom. Okay? So that is with regard to that. So let's give an example. The Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, what would be muktzah machmas chisaron kis? The example that the Shulchan Aruch gives is if you have klei hamachresha, which means if you have very elaborate, very expensive Clay machresha means like items that are used to plow the field. Very expensive, what do you call those? Like tractors, obviously a tractor is something that you need electricity to run, but if you have plows and you have things that are used in the field and it's very expensive to replace them, that would be considered muktzah machmas chiseron kis. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Or say, for example, if you have something, the Shulchan Aruch says, if you have something that I need for my work and I really would not want it to get ruined, so it may not be so expensive, but it's something that I need to use for my work. So would I be allowed to do that or perhaps not? So some practical examples that are given are, let's say I have a checkbook. How expensive is a checkbook? Not so expensive. Can I call the bank and get another one? Of course I can. Is it a pain in the neck to get a new checkbook? Yes, it is. Well, then that would be considered something that's muktzah machmas chiseron kis. Or say, for example, if I have a credit card or a passport, something of that nature. The instrument is a much simpler example because it's clear to everyone that that's an expensive item. But say, for example, I have something that is just set aside for its designated purpose. Would I be allowed to move that on Shabbos? The answer to that is no. Why? Because all of those are considered to be muktzah machmas chiseron kis. There's a major discussion today. What is the status of cell phones? Are those considered to be muktzah machmas chiseron kis or not? So I would venture to say cell phones are generally pretty expensive. And the knee-jerk reaction would be, yeah, that is very expensive. And therefore, it's muktzah machmas chiseron kis. However, there's an argument to be made on the other side, which is, we let our children play with our phones, right? Kids take phones all the time, and they're dropping them, and we have phone cases, and we don't care if they drop on the floor, because we know they're not going to break. And even if they do break, okay, this is what happens. This is par for the course of having a phone. So we're not as careful with them as we are, let's say, for a iPad or a computer or a laptop, right? We're much more careful with those than we are with our phones, which are bounced around all the time and moved around all the time. So that is a major question, whether we would say that this is considered muktzah machmas chiseron kis. Now, it would be the second category of muktzah regardless. It would be a klisha malacha le'iser, regardless. Because what you use a cell phone for is to do an iser. It's to do things that are not allowed on Shabbos. So either way, it will be a muktzah problem. But the question is, of what rules is the cell phone going to be governed or not? Each one of these categories has a different set of rules. So the rule for muktzah machmas chiseron kis will not necessarily be the same as it would be for klisha malachta le'iser, which we're going to talk about next week. And therefore, we have to really determine what exactly everything is going to fall under. Before I take your question, let me just talk about the following. Let's say, for example, I have something, let's say anybody in the room engaged? Not yet. Okay, I hope by next semester when I ask that question, we're going to have lots of people answering positively, if you want to be. So, let's say you have a young woman who's engaged, and she's really excited that she has a gown, and the gown is already finished, and she went for all of her fittings, and it's done. Now she has it in the house, and she has a whole bunch of company in the house, and she decides that she wants to try on the gown on Shabbos for all the company. Now, gowns are very expensive. You don't just wear a gown to a Shabbos meal just because, right? The only reason you're wearing it is because you want to show it to your friends. But it's not something that I would just throw around the house. It's not something I would let people handle because it's a very delicate and expensive item. Is that considered muktzah machmas chiseron kis? This is a big discussion in the Mishnah Berurah. Do we say the only thing that could be muktzah machmas chiseron kis, what's the difference between this example and all the others we gave?
Yeah.
What do you mean? It has a great use on Shabbos. I feel like a princess.
Like,
right?
You're not using it on Shabbos.
You're not using it on Shabbos. Why not?
It's for the wedding.
That's fine.
But if you ruin it, it would be very upsetting.
If I ruin a laptop, it would also be very upsetting. What do you think? What's the difference?
There's no malacha attached to it.
Oh, there's no malacha attached to it. All the other examples we gave, an instrument, a violin, a piano, a laptop, a cell phone, a pen, all the other things we spoke about are things that there's malacha involved in it. But here we're talking about something where there is no malacha involved at all. It's just a gown. Now it happens to be a very expensive gown. So the question is, would that automatically make it into something that is off limits on Shabbos because it's so expensive and I don't want people handling it, I don't want people holding it? That is a big discussion in the Mishnah Berurah, which I think is just an interesting consideration to have. Does it have to have malacha attached to it in order to be able to be in the category of muktzah machmas chiseron kis, or perhaps not? You had a question.
Yeah. Is it possible for it to change? Like, for example, example, when people get phones, a lot of times for the first 2 weeks, they're really careful.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 weeks go by, and they're kind of used to having a new phone, and
right.
they'll, like, drop it, and they don't really care as much. So, like, the first 2 weeks, it's kind of similar to a violin in, like, the first category, but then after that, you're not so careful.
Yes, and I'll give you another example. I'll give you another example in the fact that I've seen people who throw around their iPads the same way they throw around their phones. They're very wealthy. They don't care. It breaks. Okay, so we'll break. We'll get a new one. It's not the way things go in my house, but it's the way things go in other people's house. So what would you say? Is that muksa machmas chisaron kis or not? And the answer, says the Mishnah Berurah, is this category is subjective. It depends on your understanding of the item. So if you live in a house where an iPad is not considered to be such a delicate item and we just throw it around the same way we would throw anything around, so then for you, that might not be muksa machmas chisaron kis. That would be the same as a cell phone. On the other hand, if you live in the kind of house where we are very careful with it, then that would obviously have a different kind of outcome. And that would be the same with yours. If you get a brand new cell phone and you're so careful with it, then to you right now, this is muksa machmas chisaron kis. However, if you are in a position which is different, which you no longer feel that way, then obviously that status would change as well. So let's say you have an item, yeah?
Can I go back to the gown for a second?
Sure, yeah.
At my grandparents' house, we actually have, like, my aunt's wedding gown that she wore, mm-hmm. and all the other gowns that people have worn to different weddings.
Yeah.
They're still very, like, they're still, like, nice and expensive, and, like, I don't know why it's still there, but, like, I'm sure she could still sell it, and it would still, like, it's the type that, like, would still continue to wear
and you try it on just for fun?
Like, yes, we all have in the past. Should mm-hmm. we not be doing that in the future? Like, I have a lot of little cousins.
Again, this is a discussion in the Mishnah Berurah. I'm not sure your little cousins need to be machmer for the chumer of the Mishnah Berurah. I don't know.
Or other ones who are above
adult cousins.
Yeah.
Adult cousins. Uh-huh. Look, it's a big discussion. You know, it's a big discussion whether or not that's considered muksa machmas chisaron kis. But again, it gets to the heart of what is muksa machmas chisaron kis. Is it an outgrowth of klisha malachta le'isser on steroids because it's so expensive? Or do you say, no, it's a separate category? That's basically the question of what this is about. So what happens when I have a situation where, according to all standards and all measures, I have a muksa machmas chisaron kis that's in the way? I come to the table Friday night, and I totally forgot. I left my laptop on the table. That's where I work. And now I need people to sit there. What am I going to do? So what do I do? How do I get rid of it? How do I move it on Shabbos? Now, to say I should do tiltol kila'achar yad, which means to push it with the back of my hand, or to then kick it, would obviously break the laptop. So that's not an option. That's not what I want to do at all. So are there times when I'm allowed to move it, or perhaps not? Shulchan Aruch says that if a person has muksa machmas chisaron kis, that is considered to be the most extreme category of muksa. And as a result of that, the Shulchan Aruch says, you're not allowed to move it on Shabbos, even the tzarech gufo or the tzarech mekomo. You are not allowed to move it. You are not allowed to move it, even the tzarech gufo or the tzarech mekomo, which means if you're afraid, there's a flood. There's something dripping right near your laptop. So if I don't move it, it's going to end up getting ruined. That's moving it letzarach gufo. I'm moving it in order to save itself. Letzarach makomo means I need the space. I need people to sit here. Shulchan Aruch says you wouldn't be allowed to move the laptop letzarach gufo or letzarach makomo. That is what he says. However, to move it with a shinui, to move it in an unusual fashion, seems to be something that would be permissible. So if I want to use it for, if I want to move it for that reason, that would be something that I would be allowed to do. Okay? Now, somebody actually asked me, I was talking before about cell phones, right? Whether or not that's considered a klisha malachta le'isser, or is that considered muksa machmas chisaron kis? So somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago, well, even if you're going to say that, isn't there a concern that when you move the phone, it has, you know, I don't know what exactly changes on the inside of the phone, but, you know, like, your phone knows the location. So I assume, like, something in cyberspace is changing when you move a phone from place A to place B. Or, like, the Wi-Fi connection is getting weaker or stronger as you get closer to wherever the Wi-Fi is in the house. So is that a problem? So I once asked this to Rav Asher Weiss, and he said, no, that would not be an issue at all. So if I need a kick, let's say my cell phone starts ringing on Shabbos, and it's really disturbing my sleep, so I need to kick it out of the room into a closet somewhere. Now, by doing so, it could be that the Wi-Fi connection is going to get weaker, and maybe things are going to happen in cyberspace. I don't know exactly what's going to be going on. But he said that's not a problem. Why? Because I don't see anything that's changing. I'm not noticing any difference that actually happens in real time. And therefore, he said, he doesn't think this would be a problem. The Shulchan Aruch gives a very interesting example of Muksa Machmas Chisaron Kis. And this speaks to the issue you said before about the gown. Shulchan Aruch says, one of the things that we're not allowed to handle on Shabbos is paper. Paper is so expensive, Muksa Machmas Chisaron Kis. Now, obviously we know that paper is really not so expensive. And we dispose of paper all the time. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, well, in our generation, when we dispose of paper like water, and we're really not careful about paper at all, obviously the rules would change, and this would not be the same at all. So that's with regard to that. The Shulchan Aruch does give examples that in his time were considered Muksa Machmas Chisaron Kis, and in our generation it's not. However, if you have, says Rav Moshe, a fancy stationery, you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, you have a pad of prescription paper, which you know is very valuable, and you know you're not just allowed to play around with it. You can't just dispose of it. You can't have people scribbling on it. You need it for your work. In a situation like that, that is considered Muktzah Machmas Chisaron Kis, which gets back to your issue. Why should it be Muktzah Machmas Chisaron Kis when there's no malacha that's done with it? So some say, no, with paper, the only thing paper is used for is to write on. And therefore, that's called a malacha being done with it. So again, this gets to the issue that you were talking about before, whether or not we assume that something that has a, that something that has no inherent malacha that is going to be done with it, would that be part of the category of Muksa Machmas Chisaron Kis, or perhaps not? And I guess we will pick up with that next week. Let's take everyone's questions before we stop for the day. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what about the babysitter or something?
So we'll get to that. There is a special dispensation that all Sifrei Kodesh, not only Sefer Torah, but all Sifrei Kodesh